Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. It's my privilege to welcome back a guest who really needs no introduction. That's John Williams, the head of the Shadow Stats. You can find him at shadowstats.com. For those of you who've been longtime subscribers, you know I'm a longtime subscriber to Shadow Stats. It's one of my core sources of information, and whenever I'm puzzled in particular about what's going on in the economy, I go to John's website to sort out what's really happening in the data. John was a very successful economist consulting with many major corporations. And then one day, a friend of his asked him to write a series of articles about the quality of government statistics. He had been noticing and tracking that government statistics were diverging from reality. So the statistical official reality and reality were splitting, just like it was in all other aspects of our life. And so John decided to write a series of articles about, you know, sort of the differences, and it was so popular, exploded into an entire new line of business and website. Shadow Government Statistics is what the Shadow Stats stand for. So John really gets into the nuts and bolts of what's going on inside the economy and trying to express it with mathematical numbers that make sense of a lot of things. And it can really help you sort out tracking the economy. Again, shadowstats.com. So John, welcome back to the Salieri Report.
Well, thank you for having me, Catherine.
We were on the roundup. You know, we meet, our production team meets twice a week, and we're on the roundup, and sort of I was questioning what was really going on, and we were puzzling, and our producer said, maybe it's time to get John Williams back. So that's the ultimate compliment. He's the guru, can help you figure out what's really going on. Okay, so one of the things you've been tracking for a long time is the danger and risks of inflation. So why don't we start there, John, and talk about what you have been writing and saying about inflation over the last couple of years. Bring us down to the current.
Well, inflation probably is a key number that's distorting the system, and among other things, is driving some very unusual things in the way of activity of the Federal Reserve. The concept of inflation, measuring inflation, measuring the cost of living, it's been around for centuries. They had consumer price indices back a couple of hundred years ago that were in many ways like they were coming into the 1980s. What people did was they put together an index based on a group of products constantly measured over time. And the way the inflation was measured, the way people viewed it, was that effectively it was measuring the cost of maintaining a constant standard of living. You take a fixed basket of goods, very crudely, let's say a gallon of gas, a pound of beef, a loaf of bread. You'd price that basket of goods out 1 year, then you'd price it out the next year. And however much that the price of that basket changed, that was your rate of inflation. That's how much cost of living had gone up. That's how much minimally you needed to have your income go up in order to maintain your lifestyle. And that was always useful information for people. And with something like that in hand, it also was a way that people began targeting wage increases in the government, in theory, began targeting some of its programs like the cost of living adjustments to Social Security. Well, come the 1980s, people in the government and very clever economists figured you really could get away with understating inflation as in terms of the average guy, and thus save money for the government. There are a couple of other benefits that I'll get into, but two basic areas that they moved in. The first one had to do with quality adjustment. This is in the 1980s, and adjusting prices for quality adjustment on a product is perfectly legitimate. The problem is that if the consumer doesn't recognize a quality change, it ends up with a change in prices that or a lowering of inflation, if in the way it's been worked, where the consumer doesn't recognize the change that's being made. An early example, government mandated the reformulation of gasoline to improve air quality. That added at the time 10 cents per gallon to the cost of gasoline, which is quite a bit at the time. Yet the government didn't add it into the CPI because it was deemed a quality improvement. Tell you, the average guy, when he was filling his tank of gas, was not saying, oh boy, I'm gonna have better air quality. He was moaning and groaning that it was costing him an extra 10 cents a gallon to fill his gas tank before he went to work. And there actually was some furor over that, and they eventually backed off that particular measure. But the there's a whole genre of changes that were made where what they called hedonic quality adjustments, where they had computers estimate what kind of quality improvement the consumer was enjoying, even though the consumer might not recognize that quality improvement. I'll give you another simple example. I'm a very simple person technology-wise. I had a computer that I used, and for my writing and number crunching, I didn't use it for much more than that. I decided I'd replace it after 10 years. It had cost me $1,000, and I replaced it, and it cost me $1,000. And so as far as I was concerned, prices had been unchanged for computers. Now, there are a lot of things that had been done to computers in that time frame where now you could watch a movie on your computer, but I never used it for that, never recognized that as a use or anything I was paying for. But the government did. And as the government modeled it, according to all the changes they made to the prices of computers, I should have been able to buy my computer for $50. But it still cost me $1,000. But only $50 went into the CPI. Something like that, to give people a reasonable measure, and the idea here is to give people a reasonable measure of their cost of living, is to if you have a big technological change, you just define it as a new product, bring it in as a new product, and you work the other one out of the system.
Right.
Or you reduce it waiting over time. In the 1990s, all of a sudden there was a big to-do, and Alan Greenspan got involved, and Newt Gingrich got involved in terms of how we had a mistake in the CPI. And the way Greenspan explained it was that if the if you had a it was really in the area of substitution. He said if steaks get too expensive, people will buy more chicken or more hamburger instead, and so they're not going to be spending as much money. And but the CPI doesn't reflect that. Well, of course it doesn't, because the way the CPI had been designed was to maintain a constant standard of living. And as far as I'm concerned, if you got to eat chicken because your steak's getting too expensive, you're not maintaining the same constant standard of living.
Right.
But if you use the substitution there, it's just, this is something to eat, you can reduce the level of the CPI with that. And so the government passed legislation to change the CPI, come up with a new measure called the change CPI, which is just recently tacked onto the tax bill that artificially reduces inflation, at least as it used to be viewed, and that is designed to basically boost people into higher tax brackets without their knowing what's happening. The other element, which hasn't been tagged on yet to the cost of living adjustments for Social Security, but that was one of the major reasons for changing this, that they did address by changing the way they calculated the CPI. They went from actually measuring what was happening to what they called geometric weighting. So they mathematically tried to lower the, and in fact did lower the inflation measurement. And so the effect is you get lower cost of living adjustments. The average person on Social Security will tell you that he or she's not seeing a real compensation for what's changed in their cost of living when they get their cost of living adjustment to Social Security. And that's deliberate on behalf of the government. Frankly, I think it's criminal. It's effectively a tax increase, and certainly boosting people in another tax bracket's a tax increase. So put it through, be honest, make it a tax increase. Don't try and gimmick things and penalize people just because they're living on a cost of living adjustment. But putting that aside, there are two other things that come out of this. One, if you're the government reporting its economic numbers, you usually report the numbers net of inflation. You look at the gross domestic product, which is the broadest measure of the economy. That's reported net of inflation. If you are taking something that's in nominal terms before inflation adjustment and adjust it for inflation, and if you understate the inflation, you're going to end up overstating the inflation-adjusted growth. Right. And if you look at what's happened with the GDP, right now they're understating inflation on the GDP by about 2 percentage points, which basically wipes out all the headline growth you've seen in the GDP since the Great Recession, as it's now being called.
Right.
So it's there are all sorts of games that are being played there. And I just saw there's one that's, as we're talking today, the government just published its estimate of real median household income.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also inflation adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
And only, God bless the Census Bureau, they're the only people I know who use this measure. But they were behind pushing a development of a what they call the CPI-U-RS research series.
Mm-hmm.
And the research series there is saying, people want to know, we know the numbers have been changed over time. Suppose we wanted to do economic research and look at restate economic history so that the CPI was consistent over time, so that all those CPI we used in the past was consistent with the way we reported it today. What would it be? So they generated this new series that restates inflation back in time as though they had all the gimmicks in place today. When I saw that, what I did was I reverse engineered it. And I said, what happens if you reverse all the gimmicks they've been putting in and you report inflation the way it used to be? And the difference it makes is that where the government's estimating headline CPI inflation year to year of about 3%, I've got it at about 10%. And that's where it would be today if they hadn't made all these changes in terms of substitution and quality adjustment.
It's very interesting, John, that you said 10%, because I follow something called the Chapwood Index. I don't know if you've ever looked at it, but it was an investment advisor.
I've seen the Chapwood Index, and it's independently estimated, but we come up with something that's reasonably close with each other. I have actually talked with Ed Bitowski, who puts that together, but we didn't know about it before we talked with each other. That we're doing this.
Well, what was interesting is, he says in the U.S. 8 to 13%, and that's, if you look at the midpoint of that, which is, 10 or 11, that's exactly, I travel a great deal and talk to subscribers all over the world, and that's what I'm finding, that it's, that an 8 to 12% or about 10 or 11% is dead on, and that's what you say. So, and it's very frustrating if you're running a household budget and you're watching the news and it's saying 2 to 3% when you're just absolutely getting squeezed.
Yep. It's and then you have the Fed saying, the inflation is too low. we have all sorts of unusual things going on here, and what I'll contend is that what we had really massive incompetence, I think would be a mild way of putting it, probably outright fraud that even the central bank had some knowledge of, led to this banking collapse or near banking collapse in 2008. And I was involved with looking at some ratings at that time, and I saw some of the things that happened. I know some of the people involved in different elements, and there's just no way that that was not in the cards. It was predictable.
Right.
And what happened was that effectively the banking system collapsed. It never has really come back. Normally, I'll contend we're still in a state of recovery or stasis from it. That's why the Fed's having all sorts of problems today trying to get things back to normal. What they did was absolutely extraordinary. It's not just the Fed, it was the federal government. They did everything they had to do to bail out the system. They bailed out large corporations like General Motors. The Federal Reserve purchased AIG, the world's largest insurance company. Of course, they were insuring these derivative instruments that were collapsing the banking system. And the Fed went in and bought a $5 trillion worth of treasuries and bad debt off of the banks. Now, had the Fed wanted to stimulate the economy, had they wanted to create inflation, wanted to see an economic recovery, they would have let the banks lend some of that money some of that cash that the Fed gave them back into the system. When the Fed buys up treasuries, that's the way they used to control the money supply. They'd buy treasuries from the banks. The banks would have the cash. The banks would then lend the cash out into the commercial and personal loan markets. Those people would get the cash. They deposit it with their banks, and then those banks would lend out following reserve requirements, so that effectively whatever a bank first lent out, you could multiply by 10, and that's how much would end up in the money supply.
Right.
With this extraordinary amount of asset purchases by the Fed, had the banks put that into the system, you would have had a hyperinflation. The system was not stable. And what the Fed mandated simply was that the banks would not lend that money out, but rather deposit it back with the Fed as excess reserves. And the Fed paid interest to the banks on that money.
Right. So they stopped inflation and feathered their friend's nest.
Yeah. So that it's what they were doing, and all this talk about the quantitative easing, oh, we're doing this to stimulate the economy. Yeah, the Fed's our function is to prop the economy and prevent inflation. That's mandated by Congress.
Well, I would say it's to prop certain parts of the economy, because I live in a place where, you know, I've seen many economies throughout the country fall apart and die on the vine, and there's been no effort in supporting those. So there's, you know, there's demand destruction by destruction of whole sectors of the economy. I wanted to bring up, we just published a second quarter wrap-up called The Rise of the Asian Consumer. And one of the things we look at is the fact that the Asian, you know, the Asian economies are converging in terms of per capita income with the U.S., and the number of people entering the middle class is significant. And whereas, you know, for the first two decades of globalization, China was exporting deflation with cheap labor, or Asia was. Now that's reversing, and they're exporting inflation, because now, you know, you've got three times the middle class by 2030 in Asia competing with Europe and the U.S. and the developed world for commodities and resources. And now, instead of reinvesting in our cheap goods at Walmart, they're reinvesting, you know, in Eurasia along the Silk Road and in Africa, et cetera. So the deflation export machine is turning into an inflation export machine. I think that's one of the reasons we saw Trump starting the trade war with China. But I'd love to know whether you see that influence when you look at the inflation numbers.
Well, the biggest issue in inflation, and it's I'm talking in terms of what actually gets reported in the CPI, because the I mean, the CPI has all sorts of dampers on it, but a lot of the underlying factors are in there to a certain extent proportionally. Actually, it's been tied to oil and gasoline. That has been
right.
That's been the dominant factor, and a lot of that has been And the U.S. oil industry is recovering and or is expanding, and that's one bright area of the economy. But the oil prices and the volatility that you see there have been driving our headline inflation, and a lot of that's global in its scope and has nothing to do with the domestic demand. What we're seeing with our inflation, the headline inflation, is we've been through a very weak period of time in the economy. I'll contend that we've never really recovered fully from the downturn. In fact, you look at the industries such as the housing construction market. That's down anywhere from 10 to 50% from where it was back in 2007. We just haven't recovered that level of activity. Right. You look at the manufacturing sector, and there the some of the numbers are actually bloated a little bit by the headline low inflation numbers. You're still down by 5% from recovering pre-peak activity back in 2007. And the interesting thing with the manufacturing sector and industrial production, of which the manufacturing is recorded as a major component, the biggest component. The history of that series goes back to the end of World War I. We have a full century of data. And the way the economy is looked at, you have a peak. It's obvious and by its what's said, and most people view it as this peak activity. And then as the activity falls off, that's a recession. It hits a trough, and then it starts to move higher, and that's recovery. And it's recovery until you hit the prior peak level. Once you move beyond that prior peak, then you're in an economic expansion. If you look at the headline GDP, which is heavily gimmicked by these low inflation numbers, it's up 17.5% in recovery. It's something like 22% off a trough, but it's expanded beyond its pre-recession peak by 17.5%. But there's nothing that shows that, which makes it absolutely not believable. The strongest series you'll see there maybe is real retail sales, but that's deflated by the headline CPI. So that's right. That's maybe up 8% recovery. That disappears if you put in realistic numbers. The economy is not booming as advertised. It may be better than it was, but it is it's a circumstance which is not not really healthy for consumers because their income isn't growing.
Right.
You look at the headline numbers, and it gets worse when you start adjusting for inflation, accurate inflation. But if you look at the headline numbers, for example, in real earnings that get reported with the Consumer Price Index, Bureau of Labor Statistics, it's flat. It's unchanged year to year. There's down, and we've had three or four negative quarters.
So, John, the tax reform and the capital repatriation should, you know, those are pretty, and the military expenditure increase, the budget increase, those are all a significant amount of what I would call economic steroids.
Yep, and it's it'd be nice if it flowed through to the consumer. A lot of it is. God bless corporate America. You need corporate America for things to eventually really turn around. But a lot of what's happened here is that much of the productive element of the U.S. economy has been shifted offshore. And I think that's what Trump is trying to move back.
Is there any indication in the manufacturing statistics that there's any movement to insource capacity back into the U.S.?
Not yet. Where we have seen a positive move has been in the petroleum production area. That is that's booming ahead, and that's above where you were pre-recession, and that's actually pushed aggregate industrial production, as reported. It's aggregate industrial production, including that's up. It's recovered by a full 2% above its pre-recession peak.
So what I'm seeing is tremendous interest within the military-industrial complex to not be dependent on Asia for, you know, they want sort of core self-sufficiency within North America on critical sort of industries. Mm-hmm. So what I'm seeing lots of signs of insourcing, but if it's not showing up in the statistic, then maybe it's not really happening, or maybe they're just planning it.
We are off bottom there. And I think increasingly that's going to be the case. I think that's where the movement is. And you need to do something like that in order to get the domestic manufacturing back up, to get the production jobs back up. I also look at the employment and unemployment numbers. And big problem here is that a lot of people lost jobs as the manufacturing base was largely transferred overseas. Not largely, but enough of it was transferred overseas to significantly impact the higher quality production jobs, high paying jobs. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why people would look to produce offshore, and costs are one, workman compensation, all the laws that affect your costs with labor and production often can be mitigated by going offshore. That's something American people have to be willing to address as to whether or not they're willing to lose part of the productive base in the United States in order to get these cheap products, and with countries that don't buy the standards that we do in terms of regulation and safety standards and pollution standards and such, but that's beyond, I think, the scope a little bit of what we're looking at here. What I can tell you is that the underlying reality remains that the economy has not fully recovered from where it was against where it was back in 2007. A lot of that hype. It's off bottom. It's better. It is growing now. But it's we have a lot of things to be stabilized here, and the Trump administration has been moving in that area, and the trade area is a big one. Indeed, the a lot of the cost and inflation will be tied to the currency, and there you've had recently a very strong dollar. But basically, I think we've got a much weaker dollar ahead. You've had all sorts of games that are being played here by the Fed. The problem with the Fed is it's not stable.
Right.
And they're talking about it. They want to get interest rates higher. And their interest rates are now are artificially low still. And normally are set on top of inflation. If you're going to lend money, you want to get back a greater return on your money than the rate of inflation. So it used to be you could estimate where rates were going to be if you knew what inflation was doing. Well, the inflation numbers are nonsense right now. But even as reported, the treasuries in most instances are giving a negative real return.
Right. So if your inflation is 10% and your income growth is 1 to 2% and the yield on your treasuries is 1 to 2% and your expenses are rising 10% a year, that's what I call the slow burn. You're in a squeeze.
Yeah.
And that's what we've been doing for quite a while. Now, interest rates have been rising a little bit and the Fed tightening. I don't know if you've looked at the latest statistics on the U.S. debt and the interest expense. But the interest expense is accelerating and compounding the additions to the debt by a pretty significant number.
Well, that's to be expected because the debt is expanded quite a bit, and the Fed has been behind a fair amount.
Right.
It's not a stable circumstance. The I'll contend that what the Fed's done here has been everything that it has had to do to keep the banking system afloat as its primary concern, not getting the domestic economy back in any sense of normal functioning. If they could do that, that'd be fine. But you look at the banks are still not lending normally. People still have problem getting mortgages. It's not a the banks have been liquefied, but until they're functioning normally and lending normally, I'm not quite sure what it's going to take to get it going there. But the Fed is
well. I think their way of minimizing is to keep the excess liquidity circulating to the insiders and keep it away from the outsiders.
Yeah.
So if you can shut off liquidity, if you can shut off lending and equity investment on Main Street, and Main Street is starved for capital, then you can husband it all for the corporations. Mm-hmm. So I think you're talking about basically, you know, channeling all the capital in the system to the big corporations, and also trying to, you know, to channel the market share to the corporations. So the more market share the big companies can take away from the little companies, you know, the more contributions flow into the politicians, and around we go. So I wanted to bring up, John, I've done a lot of work over the last 20 years on the money disappearing from the federal government, something I call it the missing money, but it's undocumentable adjustments in the accounts. The federal government has refused since 1998 to comply with the laws related to audits or publishing financial statements, and is blatantly broken the laws related to financial management in both the Constitution and the financial management legislation. You know, so they are just, and I have we've now created whole websites of documenting all the laws broken and all the money missing. But we now have, from fiscal 1998 to 2015, government documents supporting over $21 trillion of undocumentable adjustments, which I submit. You know, I have no idea what the real number is, but I think trillions are really spent missing.
Well, I think you're right on the mark there.
Right.
I think it's the Treasury puts out an annual statement that's prepared, I believe, by the General Accounting Office, or what used to be the National Government Accountability Office. No longer accountants. But the if you look at those numbers, and they do an audit, and the auditors won't give any opinion, or they'll tell you why they won't give an opinion. And the big areas that they won't they say that, you know, we just
well I'm it. John, I'm not sure if you know this, but the Federal Accounting Standards Board just came out with a policy that would allow the Department of Defense to not include classified projects in their audit. And if you look at the wording, it's very cleverly done. But they came out with a press release at the time and made the statement, if we don't do this, then we would have to redact the entire DOD financial statements, which means we'd have to redact the entire U.S. government financial statements.
I was not aware of that. I can tell you that the last one I saw, the last financial statement I saw, and it's the thing that dooms the system, is that they do estimate the net present value of unfunded liabilities, and there are all sorts of assumptions you can make on that. But generally, they run right now. If you take the net present value of the unfunded liabilities of the government tied to things such as Medicare and Social Security, and it's current obligations, net obligations. I mean, bonds have got something like 20 trillion in bonds. You're looking at $100 trillion needed in today's money to cover the obligations that the government's already taken on. And there's just no way that it can possibly do that.
Right.
And that's what that does is eventually gives us a worthless currency, a hyperinflation, so to speak. I don't care what they do with the reporting, but you're not going to be able to buy money much for this.
Well, that's why I'm wondering if you look at the rise in the debt expense, I wonder if part of the trade war with China is not a hyperinflation fear, because if China continues to compete directly for capital and resources and export inflation instead of deflation, then the U.S. literally cannot handle the inflation that's going to result.
I think that's a fair point. Right. You have a circumstance that is it's something that needs really a reorganization of the government and the entitlement programs. If it's not addressed soon, we will have a crisis much sooner than later, in which things are going to blow apart, and I think you're going to end up in a hyperinflationary financial crisis.
Well, let's talk about how that happens, because what we're talking about is a situation where we go into a situation where the world is not buying treasury securities in dollars.
Yep.
They're less likely to take dollars. And so the Fed is going to have to be essentially the bank printing them.
Right.
So you get into debasement of the value of the dollar as they print.
Yep.
And the debasement accelerates. And what that means is the trade deficit skyrockets. That could be, to a certain extent, what's happening with the trade deficit now.
Well, it's what it will reflect. You get to the bottom line is that the U.S. dollar will have no real purchasing power for the for those who are living in the world denominated in U.S. dollars.
Right.
It is back when Standard & Poor's downgraded the treasuries a couple of years back. It was probably 10 years back now. Ex-Fed Chairman Greenspan made the very salient point. The debt the U.S. owes is in dollars, and we can print as many dollars as we want. No chance of defaulting, and that's true from that standpoint. Debasing a currency, hyperinflation is generally not an event of default in the Treasury securities, but it does give you the hyperinflation gives you worthless currency. That's what he's promising. That's where we're headed. And if you're looking to turn the situation around, and I were President Trump, I would have maybe approached things a little differently coming into office rather than claiming economic victory on day one. He didn't have a cooperative Congress, which is a problem that maybe will get addressed some in this upcoming election.
So just give us 1 minute, though. If you were the president, what else would you do to try and turn this around?
Well, what I would do, I'll contend that Trump got elected and surprised all the pundits, supposedly, because Main Street USA voted for him. Main Street USA is feeling the economic pain that we're discussing here.
Right.
It is... You can play around with it in the press and have all sorts of happy news and what you report, but if people don't believe it, the reason they don't believe it is they're not experiencing it, and they'll vote for change, and that's what happened. And with that kind of an entree, and this is something that can still be done, you address the country, say, hey, look, we all know there's a major problem here. We're financially bankrupt as things currently stand over time. We need to do something to address the problem today to have a future for our children. It may require some financial pain on the part of all of us to bring this into balance, but if we can come up with a way of structuring our long-term fiscal conditions so that the United States is solvent, so the U.S. Treasury is solvent, we'll have the strongest currency in the world. We can bring a lot of investment into the United States. You stabilize the dollar. If you can get the currency markets to buy that the U.S. long term is stable, the dollar will be fundamentally strong.
But John, what you would need is something in the United States where the general population, particularly the middle class, trust the leadership. And I would say that the leadership trust is extremely low. Now, certainly in the heartland, the election, you know, improved the sense of trust. So small business in the heartland feels much more trustworthy, and that's what the surveys and polls say. But I would say that if you look at the productivity statistics, productivity is not growing. And I can tell you why productivity is not growing, because I run a small business. And, you know, the cost of compliance with regulation. So this year, I have two companies. One company had an audit. And if you look at the methodology they use for costing out the price of an audit, it's dictated by the SEC. The cost of the audit was more than my total revenues for the year. Now, if you look at what I spend on regulatory, tax, compliance, legal, litigation, you know, I would say that 50% or more of my overhead goes into back office.
Yep.
And that's because, you know, there's a war on small business led by government. And it's got nothing, you know, every time the bad guys steal, they load up more regulatory requirements on the honest guys, as if that's some kind of solution. It's not. So productivity is going down in this country, and it's going down because the economic warfare, I believe, is totally intentional, and it's meant to destroy productivity. I mean, the way you protect against inflation is you cycle the money to the insiders, but then you drown the outsiders with so much regulatory burden and sort of surveillance and suppression. You know, they're spending all day complying with Paperwork Reduction Act requirements.
Yep. It's difficult to argue with you there. In terms of what you were talking about and the overwhelming paperwork that the average business has to put up with just to comply with all the regulations and such. I think that's one thing that resulted in the change in direction in the presidency as far as
Absolutely.
Public is concerned. And
Absolutely.
He has, President Trump has done a fair amount where he can do things by order and executive order and such. It's difficult when the Congress doesn't cooperate and you have a system here that's been working to push a system one way for so long, and it's so embedded in that direction that it's really an extraordinary political circumstance. I've never seen anything quite like this.
Well, what you're doing, John, is you're channeling the profits to the big guys. So there are thousands of different ways of doing it. It's highly complex. But when you add it all up, it's moving all the earnings into the big guys and popping it in the stock market and then leveraging it with derivatives. And it generates lots of, you know, money for a variety of players. It's an inside game. And the problem is it's stripping the real economy and it's stripping the vitality and the diversity of the economy. And it's interesting. I don't know if you follow how closely you follow the stock market, but Jeremy Grantham in 2017 threw in the towel and said, these are my words, not his. I put up the quotes on the Solera report. You know, basically, politically, monopolies are being engineered politically, and it's not economic, and it doesn't reflect market economies. It's just an engineered, centrally controlled economy. And when Jeremy Grantham throws in the towel and says that, you know, it's bad.
Well, you know, that's there's one fallacy in the broad thinking there, and that is that you still need a consumer to drive the economy.
Right, absolutely. Henry Ford knew that if his workers couldn't buy cars, it wasn't going to work.
Yeah,
so yeah.
That's what they're doing now, and what the Fed is doing now is squeezing the consumer, and it's going to be self-defeating. We're headed for a great crisis here. The Fed has allowed that it can come back in and do some more quantitative easing if the economy softens. Not that they want to stimulate the economy, but it means if the economy turns down, which I think it is doing, it's going to stress the earnings of the banks again. and they'll use a quantitative easing to keep the banks afloat. I think they should have let the banks collapse back in 2008 and reorganize the system. The Fed was behind a lot of what happened there. If you read the literature out of the Fed at the time, they're encouraging all these wonderful derivative instruments that would enable the banks to share in the risks of the insurance industry and the insurance industry to share in the risks of the banks.
John, I have a different take on this all because I was Assistant Secretary of Housing and then lead financial advisor to HUD. The mortgage securities fraud was absolutely massive, and it was engineered top-down by the Fed and the New York Fed member banks. They all knew, and it was absolutely engineered. And so what they did was they issued, I would say $20 trillion plus in fraudulent securities, and then they stuck the bill to the taxpayer, which meant somebody got off with a lot of money, free and clear. So I would say it was a bank robbery, and the banks came out, with much bigger market share. The market share of the banks that engineered that is now today much bigger. They have much more of the federal credit to use. And they're fat and happy.
Yeah, it can only be fat and happy so long if the instrument you're milking is continued to provide a little milk.
And right.
Disappear.
They were always planning to replace the U.S. consumer with the global consumer. And I think that's why they're so angry about China closing out the American companies, because it's not quite working.
Yeah.
That's what Make America Great Again is. They're like, we need more earnings in our home base.
Yeah, that would do.
Anyway, okay, John, you've been very generous with your time. Over the next 6 months, if people can have the time to watch three indicators, including on your website, what should they watch? What should they keep an eye on to keep an eye on inflation and how the economy is doing?
I would, right now, I'd look at the 2 week elements that are very difficult to have weak and have a strong economy. One is manufacturing and the other is the construction housing industry. If the construction and housing continue as they are and they're down 50% from where they were in 2007, and they're not rebounding, and they're beginning to flatten out and turn down. The manufacturing's beginning to turn down again. You're going into a nosedive in broad economic activity. They puff up the numbers with some newly created things such as not that the concepts are new, but putting them into the GDP such as intellectual property.
Right.
He had $1 billion to the economy by taping the Olympics in Korea. That's now a new electoral bond. That actually was in the trade deficit, intellectual property. I'm sure they're going to watch that again.
This is why we have to maintain our state of amusement. Okay, John Williams, Shadow Stats. We can subscribe. You have a lot of information for free at shadowstats.com. So check out the website, but also the subscription is very reasonable for what you get. This is a man who can make sense out of the puzzle palace of government statistics and all the economic statistics. You make it remarkably easy for us non-economists to kind of follow and see what's happening. And it's a great website, John. And I just want to tell you, I'm a loyal subscriber and I'm going to be with you as long as you're willing to do this. So I want to thank you.
Well, I thank you, Catherine. I follow your material and greatly enjoy it.
Have a great day.
Same to you.